I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. So here's a question for you. What happens when some of our greatest innovators, the scientists, technology pioneers, find themselves unemployed? Well, in the case of many Cold War era physicists, the answer was, go get a job on Wall Street. So what have mathematicians and computer scientists and physicists brought to the stock market? The billionaire investor Warren Buffett once warned us of geeks bearing formulas. But my next guest, James Weatherall, isn't so sure that we should be afraid of the new wave of techies in finance. He's also the author of The Physics of Wall Street. James Weatherall, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm going to start with that kind of tough indictment from Warren Buffett, who said in 2009, of course, that was a really tough year. He writes a letter to his shareholders. Of course, one of the richest men in the world writes to those who are investing in Berkshire Hathaway and says, look, we've become too impressed with, and this is a quote, a nerdy sounding priesthood using esoteric terms such as beta, gamma, sigma, and the like. Our advice, beware of geeks bearing formulas. So when you heard that, did you think, gee, I don't know, that's misplaced blame? Or did you think, well, maybe he's put his finger on something there?
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. I think that there's a strong sense in which he's right. We should beware of geeks bearing formulas. But I think that awareness, that, you know, the sense of caution that you should take to these models doesn't mean that we shouldn't use them. And doesn't mean that they aren't an important part of financial practice now and that they couldn't be an even more important part going forward. I think that attitude, there's a sense, it's sort of funny. I mean, Buffett himself, of course, employs plenty of geek-sparing formulas. It's just part, though, of how he approaches finance and investing.
Well, okay, so when you heard people after the crash, as they did, say, look, the reason that things got so messed up is because we had all these people, some people call them quants, you know, people with PhDs in math and science and computer science and physics, and they descended on Wall Street and they came up with formulas nobody understood, and it really messed up our financial system. Is that true? To what degree is that true?
Well, I think that there's a sense in which it's true. There's a very particular model in particular that sort of went south in 2008 and caused us a lot of problems. And, you know, I think that my reaction when I read those sorts of things was to say, well, you know, surely someone understood these things. I mean, the people who were coming up with them understood them. And what I wanted to understand in the book that I wrote, The Physics of Wall Street, is how their understanding of these models differed perhaps from some of the people who were using them, in particular, the people who were using them to disastrous consequence for the rest of us.
And it's interesting, too, because you talk about physicists who got into the Wall Street game, and I think of one of them in particular, Jim Simons, who started this Renaissance Medallion Fund. And this is a quote from your book, which is, it's this kind of it's really striking number, but you say the fund earned an unparalleled 2,478% return, blowing every other hedge fund in the world out of the water. To give you a sense of how extraordinary this is, George Soros' Quantum Fund, the next most successful fund during this time, earned a mere 1,700% over the same period. So how did physicists come to be so good in some ways at playing this Wall Street game? And I should say, this guy who's head of Renaissance is now one of the richest people in the world.
That's right. Those numbers reflect returns for the 90s. More recently, Renaissance has done, or at least the Medallion Fund at Renaissance has done just as well. So it seems to me that what people like Simons and the team of people he has working for him at Renaissance, and it's worth noting, those aren't people with backgrounds in finance or economics. The only kinds of people he hires there are people with backgrounds in physics and mathematics and computer science.
And in fact, he says, like, if you worked on Wall Street, if you have a background in finance and MBA, we're not interested in you.
Yeah, that's right. You need not apply. So it seems to me that what they're doing is they're bringing to bear it's a little bit misleading to say it's physics. It's really it's methods from physics. It's methods of using mathematics to try to understand the world and make predictions as best we can. They're using those methods with the kind of sensitivity to their potential shortcomings, to their limitations, that one, I think, gets an appreciation of if you get your hands dirty and really work with these things. And it seems to me that what they're doing that, let's say, other hedge funds or other banks who are trying to use these kinds of models aren't doing is recognizing the ways in which the methods that they use are most effective when you understand their limitations.
And you say that in some ways the market, so the market in a lot of ways, I think to many people, seems pretty random. But you say things that are random seemingly by themselves, like the behavior of an ant or something. When you look at an ant colony, when you look at all these things together, they're not that random at all.
Well, what I would say actually is that there may well be senses in which they're random, but randomness doesn't mean unpredictability. If you think about flipping a coin, for instance, whether it comes up heads or tails is random.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say an awful lot about what we should expect for the long-term behavior of that coin. If I flip the coin a million times, I can tell you that it's going to be about half heads and about half tails. So that's a kind of prediction that I can make on the basis of a random process.
And that's what physicists have been able to do, or mathematicians have been able to do to a certain degree with Wall Street, sort of look at this stuff in aggregate and figure out how to make money looking at the big picture.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So I think one of the interesting things that you talk about in the book is how did physicists end up on Wall Street in the first place? And one of your answers in some ways is they didn't have jobs. So explain how it happened that physicists migrated out of physics departments and onto Wall Street.
Well, sure. I mean, there was a sort of fascinating series of things that all happened right around the same time, the late 60s and the early 1970s. Yeah, so we landed on the moon, and immediately Congress cut funding to NASA by, you know, roughly 50%, and then went down from there. This meant that a generation of physicists who had gone to graduate school with the promise of these wonderful government research jobs, lots of funding for university physics jobs, graduated to find a severely depressed job market. Now, at the same time, the first U.S. options exchange, the first time that there was an exchange for trading derivatives in the U.S., opened in 1973. That same year, a very, very famous financial model, mathematical model, developed first by some physicists and mathematicians, and then by financial economists sort of building on that work, was published, the Black-Scholes model. And so in the early 70s, we found ourselves in a situation where there were thousands of unemployed physicists, a new derivatives exchange, and a model that showed just how useful the kinds of things that physicists were trained to do could be for understanding this new market.
Now, how common is it now that people who are getting PhDs in physics, in math, in computer science are leaving those disciplines when they graduate and getting jobs in finance?
I think it's fairly common, although it's not entirely clear that people who are getting degrees in physics are going to Wall Street as their first choice. I think it continues to be, in many cases, that people either get undergraduate degrees or in many cases get graduate degrees in mathematics or physics, intending to go on to a research career, and find that there just aren't enough jobs for all the PhDs that we produce. And Wall Street is a very attractive plan B.
You quote a MIT mathematician who said, you know, in some ways, the very best physics department is in this little town in Long Island where Renaissance, this huge hedge fund, is. That's the best, probably, physics department in the world. Is something lost by having the best physics department in the world be not at Harvard, not at Stanford, you know, not at MIT, not at a place that basically we can access?
It seems to me that the answer is yes. There is something lost about that. Something perhaps sad about that. Of course, Harvard, MIT, and Stanford aren't hurting in their physics departments. It's not that they're having difficulty getting good people because Wall Street is gobbling them up. In many ways, Renaissance Technologies is the exception that proves the rule in all sorts of ways. I think that they have phenomenally talented people there, but they haven't somehow cornered the market on talented physicists and mathematicians.
So when you look going forward, do you see Wall Street simplifying, or is there kind of an arms race again amongst big banks, you know, whether it be Citibank, whatever, to staff up and get your physicist and your mathematician on staff so that you can compete with the other banks?
Well, I think that arms race has been going on now for about 30 years, and we're seeing the consequences of it. It seems very difficult for me to imagine Wall Street simplifying. That seems in many ways like a step backwards that no bank could take unilaterally, and no one is going to somehow force on them. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, the growth in the financial services sector over the period during which physicists have migrated to Wall Street has been really remarkable. In fact, it's been a major part of U.S. economic growth over that period.
So is all this sort of technical stuff getting into Wall Street, is it hurting the ability, do you think, of the individual person, the person who does not have a PhD, to compete, to be a successful investor? Because, look, the deck is stacked. There are people with much better algorithms than you have out there working on them.
Well, this is a somewhat difficult question because the deck was stacked against the individual investor before physicists got to Wall Street. I mean, you don't need a PhD in physics to have a little bit more wherewithal when it comes to valuing stocks, valuing companies, to having the connections to, you know, go to all the shareholders meetings and things like that. So the real question is, are things worse now for the individual investor now that trading has become more mathematically technical? And it's not really clear to me that the answer to that is yes. I think that in many cases, the kinds of markets where physicists have really been able to get a grip have been ones that are fairly obscure as far as the individual investor goes. It's they're often derivatives markets, or alternatively, they may be ordinary stock markets, but the sorts of things that physicists are doing are very, very high frequency, so very short timescale trades that really aren't competing with someone who's, you know, buying and holding Apple or Microsoft.
Yeah, but we have heard a lot of criticism of those, you know, fraction of a second kinds of trades. You don't think that is that sort of messing up the way that the market works? And I think well over 50% of trades now are these sort of fraction of a second automated. It's not like a human being is putting in a trade order. I want to buy some Google, or I want to, you know, sell some GE.
That's right. In fact, by some estimates, it's as much as 70% of volume is high-frequency traders. I think that, you know, insofar as the individual investor is trying to compete with those people, sure, that they have no chance. I mean, institutional investors have no chance in many cases. But as I say, that's not usually what the individual investor is doing. On the other hand, there are dangers. So, for instance, in 2010, in May of 2010, we saw the so-called flash crash, where the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 600 points in, you know, a minute. And I think many people put their finger on high-frequency traders as the people who, if they didn't cause it, they somehow enabled or amplified what otherwise would have been a fairly small event.
Right.
And that seems to me to be a problem for market regulators, for, you know, figuring out how to you know, put stopgap measures or shutoff measures in place in order to prevent that sort of market malfunction from occurring. It doesn't seem like that's somehow an essential problem with high-frequency trading.
Let me finally ask you, you talk about how do you deal with something like the flash crash. How do you deal with regulation? You know, clearly, people who have PhDs in physics and math who are on Wall Street, they're making a lot of money, you know, $2, $3, $4, or more $100,000 a year. How do regulators, most of whom don't have nearly the kind of mathematical training, possibly keep up with physicists, with mathematicians who are employed by the big banks or by hedge funds like Renaissance, who are, you know, they might be making millions a year?
Well, it seems to me that given the way we understand market regulation now, it's simply impossible. But one of the things that I argue in the Physics of Wall Street is that markets have changed in such a way that it's time for us to reconsider how we understand regulation, in particular that we need to start using the kinds of methods that groups like Renaissance and other mathematically sophisticated hedge funds use in order to make more effective rules and policies for markets. The way I think about it is that these methods, these mathematical tools, are simply a way of getting a certain kind of information out of markets. But that information is relevant, if used properly, to anyone who's trying to make decisions regarding market behavior. And regulators certainly fall in that camp.
So you're saying that regulators should cough up the money to probably hire some of these people themselves?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think for a moment about how much we spend, for instance, on defense or intelligence, you know, what you can think of as physical security, and you compare that to how much the government spends on market regulation and economic policy making and just studies of market behavior, and the latter is paltry. Meanwhile, the cost of a crisis like the crisis in 2008, which by some estimates was in the tens of trillions of dollars, seems to dwarf the cost of any real plausible threat to the homeland. And I think that we need to think about economic security and an investment in economic security in the same way that we think about our investment in physical security. This is important, and I think it's worth spending money on.
James Owen Weatherall, the author of The Physics of Wall Street, looking at what Wall Street has become, what it is becoming, and how do you regulate it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what used to be the kind of technology that could exist only in science fiction has become increasingly common in 21st century warfare. And I'm talking about the use of drones. How do they really work? And how does human military personnel interact with unmanned weapons? I'll be bringing you that conversation next. I'm Kara Miller, and this is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.